Hi, welcome to Infill. Today we have a very special guest. I'm Laura Clark, and we're here with Brian Hanlon. But most importantly of all, we have State Senator-elect Scott Wiener.
Thank you. And the elect actually disappeared a couple of days ago.
Oh. Okay, wait, I'm going to do that again then. Today we are going to talk about some new legislation that Scott just introduced around housing. I think it's the first thing that he's done, and we are really excited. So Scott, please tell us more.
Sure. So thanks for having me. It's exciting to be able to work with the community in this new capacity in the state Senate and take some of our great work in San Francisco and try to take it statewide. So I was sworn in on Monday and introduced my first bill, SB 35, which is a bill to make it easier to create housing in California. Our housing crisis is no longer a few random cities that have high housing costs. It is a statewide issue, and more parts of the state are really suffering, and particularly young people and vulnerable communities and low-income, middle-class people. It's a real problem. And we can't treat housing as a city-by-city siloed situation anymore. It's a statewide problem that needs a statewide solution. That doesn't mean that the state starts micromanaging or taking over local housing decisions, but the state needs to set better accountability parameters to make sure that all communities are participating in creating housing. And so SB 35 basically will provide greater accountability for something called the Regional Housing Needs Assessment, or RHNA, R-H-N-A. And what RHNA is we're required under state law every region to assign a housing number to every community, to say over the next 25 years, you, community X, are supposed to build whether it's 500 or 10,000 or 100,000 units of housing. The problem is that right now, when that number is set and then updated every 5 years, there's no repercussions for blowing it off. And so some communities meet the goals. Some communities try really hard to meet the goals, but struggle. And some communities just blow it off. And there are no consequences for doing that. So SB 35 will provide, and we're fleshing out all the details now, but basically it will provide that for communities that are not meeting their RHNA goals, some sort of streamlining will kick in to say basically that it's your local control in terms of how you meet your housing goals. We're not going to micromanage how you do it, but local control does not mean blowing off your housing goals. And that's what SB 35 will do. The other piece of it is we want to overall streamline the approval process for affordable housing, so for 100% affordable housing, because we so desperately need it. We did that here in San Francisco earlier this year. I authored legislation to streamline the approval process for affordable housing. We want to take that statewide.
That is so great to hear. I mean, I think especially when we've gone down to like Brisbane or other suburbs to attempt to shame them about not making their RHNA goals, the response has been from some of them, well, the next town over is even worse than we are, so whatever. There's just no accountability when it comes to RHNA numbers, and we sort of hoped that publicizing it might be enough, but I'm really glad to hear that you guys are going to add some actual consequences to just disregarding those numbers.
Yeah, Scott, so could you tell us a little bit more about how this your proposed legislation will work? If a municipality hits like a certain threshold of their RHNA numbers, do they then just like no state action takes place? But if they fail to meet a certain threshold, is it then going to be something akin to the governor's proposed streamlining measures last year, where they have to just follow their own rules and they have to more or less approve proposed housing developments if it complies with their local zoning and general plan?
So, and by the way, one thing I forgot to mention before is that all of this is subject to paying prevailing wage. One of the governor's as of right legislation, which, by the way, I give the governor enormous credit for calling the question about housing being a statewide issue. There were problems with the proposal. It made it too easy to demolish rent-controlled housing, and it didn't deal with some of the labor issues. We don't want to create poverty jobs in construction. We want people to have good pay. And one of the major objections was around prevailing wage, because in many parts of the state, the building trades have no leverage to actually get prevailing wage. What we introduced, it's called an intent bill, where it's not fully fleshed out in terms of all the details. It's a summary of this is what we intend to flesh out, and then replace the language with something more formal. So once we do that, we're going to be working with a broad array of stakeholders. We want this to be a collaborative process. It will address issues like, what is the trigger? Is it, because it can be challenging to 100% meet all of your RENA goals. Particularly the hardest part is moderate income housing, because you don't even get federal tax credits. So it may be that there will be certain goalposts. So even if you're not meeting at 100%, if you're, you know, coming close and making a good faith effort, that may be enough. In terms of what the streamlining is, it could take a number of different forms. As of right is certainly one of those forms, but there are various ways that one could envision streamlining. And so, again, those will be topics of discussion as we flesh out the legislation.
Yeah, it's great to hear that you guys are really putting a priority on bringing all the stakeholders in. I think one thing that we were really frustrated, you know, we kind of had to watch By Right die a fiery death, as, you know, I think Governor Brown, really well-intentioned, hasn't done a great job of bringing stakeholders in. He kind of is a little bit of a my way or the highway kind of a guy. That's his political style. And a lot of people said, you know, we'll take the highway. And, you know, it's good to know that this concept hasn't died, but that, you know, by bringing more of the stakeholders in, there's a little bit more of a potential for, you know, improvements and bringing people in who, you know, frankly, I think the growing chorus of people who are realizing that we're in such a dire crisis with housing is now starting to bring in, you know, teachers, nurses. There's a lot of stakeholders, especially when it comes to moderate income interest groups, who can be brought in for something like what you're talking about.
Have you talked to any other developers or folks at the UC Berkeley Turner Center, for instance, that study feasibility of housing policy changes? Because my concern is that while prevailing wage certainly works if you're talking about construction in San Francisco, it works if you're talking about construction near downtown or the expensive Western neighborhoods in Los Angeles, but that in many communities in California, the delta between the prevailing wage and what construction workers would ordinarily get is pretty large, to the extent that all sorts of types of housing products simply don't pencil if you make that a requirement. Relatedly to your point earlier about how it's really tough to hit your moderate income targets because there are no sources of federal funds to subsidize moderate construction. Moderate construction just does not pencil at all in San Francisco, given the high your high hard costs and that your high land cost. But it does pencil in certain places in the region. I mean, for instance, the suit that my organization brought against Lafayette was for moderate income housing. A private market rate developer proposed to build 315 apartment units that would have been affordable to moderate income people. Because if you're talking about just stick, you know, built structures, three stories high, you know, in dense apartment buildings on land that this family's owned for generations, they could actually make a profit off of moderate income housing, indeed restricted. Now, that also worked because Lafayette's area median income is pretty high. But my concern is that this is going to be a great thing to move housing forward in cities like San Francisco, but it might not do much in some of these other communities.
So, the prevailing wage, you know, the rationale for prevailing wage is that you do have, there are developers that will pay basically poverty wages to their construction workers, and we want to, you know, make sure that we're lifting people up into the middle class. And, you know, we know the prevailing wage between Republican and Democratic presidents is a political football. Every time a Democratic president comes in, they issue a pro-prevailing wage executive order that the next Republican president then rescinds. And it's definitely a complicated issue, but the general goal is we want these jobs to be good-paying jobs. This legislation would not mandate prevailing wage for all construction in California. It's simply if you're utilizing the streamlining, prevailing wage kicks in. Developers would never be required to invoke that streamlining.
Yeah, I mean, I'm less interested. You know, maybe there will be projects that don't pencil out because of the prevailing wage thing, but it also means that for the political battle that we will likely be going into, you know, I think we need to be really conscious of the fact that we need labor to be on the side of these things and looking for places where, you know, if we're working against labor when we're trying to get more housing built, you know, it's going to be a slog. And I think we need them as an ally.
And when I, before I introduced this bill, I did reach out to various groups just to give them a heads up that we're, you know, we're introducing this, it's in summary form, we're going to include you in the discussions around fleshing it out. And one thing I said to one of the unions that I've worked with a lot in letting them know about it, I said, we want to make sure that your members are able to have a wage that they can live on and support their families, but also that they have a place to live. And I think that a lot of people in labor deeply understand that in addition to the critical wage and benefits issues that their members are getting so hard hit by the lack of housing.
So could you explain a little bit the source of labor strength in the Democratic Party in California? My understanding is that particularly with respect to the building trades, which was the most powerful actor in stopping Governor Brown's buy right proposal, that they've been losing members for years. They used to have much more of a presence in single-family home construction. They almost have none now. They're way down in mid-rise construction, and now their real stronghold is in the type of, you know, dense steel and concrete tower construction in the expensive cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles. So, like, what is the source of their strength? You know, just it seems to me that it's, well, I remember when I was campaigning, whether you know, volunteering with your campaign or volunteering with other campaigns, that most of the that the number one source of volunteers were union members. Like, these are the people who they go out and they move votes. The number two group, at least that I saw, were YIMBY party type people. And so my question is that the main source of their political strength, that the fact that they're able to, you know, to move a lot of votes for candidates?
Yeah, we had a great coalition on our campaign. I loved it. I think the building trades are, you know, I don't have all the data on the trends, but there are they still have a significant presence, and they have to fight really hard for these projects. And in a place like San Francisco, even though there are certainly struggles, it's a lot easier for them here. There are other parts of the state where they really have to struggle to get these developments to be union jobs that are paying prevailing wage, and it ends up being a war in a lot of these communities, and that's why, you know, I think the trades, they are concerned with some forms of streamlining because it reduces the leverage that they have, not so much in San Francisco. Because, for example, I did CEQA legislation in San Francisco 4 or 5 years ago to streamline the appeal process for CEQA. And we got it passed. It was a big war with some of the groups that just don't want more housing. Our local trades supported that legislation, because in San Francisco, they know that some of these appeals and processes are not used to get prevailing wage and middle class jobs. They're used to just shut down development. Whereas statewide, it's not necessarily the case. So we're trying to be sensitive to the dynamic all across the state, not just in San Francisco. And I think anything we can do, as you said, Laura, to bring labor into the pro-housing alliance is a good thing. Labor, I think, fundamentally is pro-housing. The trades are fundamentally pro-housing. They want more housing. They get it, not just for more housing means more jobs, and it means more housing for their members. And so we're just trying to take away that that internal problem that can push the trades into a different camp because they don't want to have more housing that simply creates poverty jobs, which I totally am sympathetic to.
Yeah, Scott, I really appreciate that. The fact that we're sometimes at loggerheads with labor in the pro-housing camp is a very frustrating thing for me because, like, as you said, I think, you know, I don't want to help create lots more poverty jobs. I want there to be a strong labor movement in California and in the United States. I think it's important for achieving all sorts of progressive objectives, even apart from housing. One other question about your proposal. You talked about how this is going to be tied to RENA allocation numbers. Are you giving any thought to revising how those numbers are determined? Because as we see now under the 2014 to 2022 cycle, these are based on job projections from 2010. So we're like locked into pre-tech boom job projections across this whole lengthy planning period. And what's more, they're based on population estimates. Well, population estimate is going to be biased downward with each successive cycle because housing is so damn high. If housing weren't so expensive, you would see higher population growth. So it's like a type of methodology that systematically underestimates the number of housing needed.
And yet, even those systematic underestimations, nobody is meeting those goals. Yes, that is a little ironic right there.
Yeah. There are many different challenges we have with
solve everything at once.
Yeah, regional planning, and I'm sure that we can that's something to be looked at. But I agree with Laura. I mean, step one is to start meeting the goals that we're actually setting. You know, we just did some work when I was on the MTC before I resigned upon being sworn into the state senate. The work that we do around Plan Bay Area and some of the projections, it just makes me nuts because even these projections are, if they're met, will result in increased housing costs. It'll be less of an increase, but the problem is still moving in a bad direction.
Yes. Is there anything else that you think is really important for people to know? How can they follow along, you know, offer assistance? You know, how can people get involved to support this kind of legislation?
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to say that I'm not just kissing butt here or anything, but I'm just so happy that the YIMBY party exists because I think I've said this before publicly that when I first came on the Board of Supervisors in 2011, and it didn't exist yet. At least I wasn't aware of it. And we would have hearings around housing at City Hall, and it would just be opponents. And having an organized group of people who are pro-housing, it makes a big, big difference. So it's great for people to be involved. You can follow the work that I'm doing I'm very active on Facebook and Twitter, and we try to update people. We are definitely looking for interns and volunteers in our office, particularly in the district, to help out, and we plan to do a lot of organizing, so that's a way to get involved. But we do have these hearings in Sacramento, and I know that the YIMBY party has gone up before, and I encourage people to continue to do that in an organized way.
Could you talk a little bit about a bill that you are also co-sponsoring, the bill that's providing funds for affordable housing? Because, you know, it seems to me to be very strange. I mean, all of your critics said you were this tool of real estate interest. And yet, so I assume that you must be playing some sort of 11th dimensional chess with your real estate overlords, because you're co-signing a bill that includes a $75 fee for real estate transactions, which is something they are vehemently opposed to. So what's going on, Scott?
You know, whether it's whether you're President Obama or the local dog catcher, in politics you get caricatured, and you know, they said I was the quote unquote corporate candidate, even though I've been at war with various industries for years. And you know, it's just the nature of politics, you get caricatured. I've worked with the realtors on various issues, and there are times when we've respectfully disagreed. And if you as a elected official can't work with people and then disagree with people, even sometimes while you're working with them, and separate those issues, then you shouldn't be in elected office. I can't think of an ally of mine that I haven't at times disagreed with, and that's what being a good elected official is about. You know, the state does not do enough to fund affordable housing, period. And in San Francisco, where we're a wealthier city, we are able to generate a fair amount of local investment. There are so many cities and towns that do not have the ability financially to fund low-income housing or any kind of affordable housing. And the state needs to help. And we need a funding source. And I give Senator Tony Atkins from San Diego a lot of credit for taking leadership on this funding bill, which I'm happy to co-author with her. I'm cautiously optimistic we'll be able to get it across the finish line.
A lot of YIMBYs have been following the appointment of Ben Carson to HUD with unbelievable horror, and are becoming really concerned about what's going to happen, you know, with Section 8 housing and sort of all the funding that goes to affordable housing. And we know that, like, even the affordable housing projects that have been fully paid off to the city, you know, there are a lot of loans that go into the construction of these things, even ones that are thought of as self-sufficient are actually subsist on HUD funding that's constantly coming into those buildings. And I would say we're terrified about what might happen. You know, the HUD funding has been going down for decades. But if we suddenly turn off the spigot, you know, what I'm wondering what you guys are thinking about the potential, you know, I don't want to say for disaster, but how disaster might be averted with state action.
Yeah, when I read in the paper that Ben Carson had been named or nominated as the HUD secretary, I thought for a minute I was reading The Onion. But then I realized that it was reality. And I'm tempted not to read about his appointments anymore after Steve Bannon and Jeff Sessions, but we have to read about it, unfortunately. You know, the federal government has been abdicating from housing since Ronald Reagan, and the federal housing support has been gutted, and it's a national tragedy. It's ridiculous that Ben Carson will potentially be heading HUD. But it just points out that we have to assume the worst about this administration. I hate to assume the worst, but we have to on so many things, and housing will be another one. Hopefully they won't get rid of the affordable housing tax credits, although they probably like tax credits. But though I've heard recently that because they are talking about lowering income taxes, the market for affordable housing tax credits is being depressed because they're potentially worth less. So I think we're going to see a lot of nastiness coming out of this administration, and it is all the more important for California and for the states to step up to take a bigger role in housing.
So now that you're going to be doing statewide stuff, you know, YIMBYs are probably going to want to also complain about how the Bay Area has, I think it's like more than 30 different public transportation systems that don't necessarily talk to each other. I know I personally get frustrated with how Muni doesn't integrate with BART. And, you know, luckily we just passed the BART bond. But I know you've been a massive transportation advocate. And I'm wondering what you plan on doing with that, since it is so critical to housing as well at the state level.
We're going to be in a world of hurt with housing if we don't get together, and we're going to be in also a world of hurt with transportation if we have 2 million more people in the Bay Area and a million more cars on the roads. It just doesn't work. And so I, on the Board of Supervisors, I definitely fought hard to try to get more investment into transit, and the state does not do enough. In terms of the transit agencies, I think it's 28, actually. Last I checked, I might be wrong about that, but that was the last number I saw. I'm not overly optimistic that we're going to start merging transit agencies. I do think we're going to see better and better integration. I mean, the Clipper card was a major step forward. There's a lot more work to do, however. But first and foremost, we have to shore up these systems. And the BART bond was incredibly important, but there's still a lot more work to do with BART. San Francisco's sales tax failed. We need to try that again. We need more of that local and regional money, but the state needs to step up in a big way for public transportation, and it has not done so. I've signed on as a co-author to a major transportation funding bill, but I sometimes get concerned that more money will get pushed to roads and less to transit. We need to shore up transit.
So could you talk a little bit about how we're going to fund all these housing and transit initiatives? You know, Californians love to say how we're super progressive, how we're going to lead this country in this era of darkness. And yet, you know, with propositions J and K in San Francisco, the stuff to spend the money on passed by about 2-1, but the actual tax to fund those expenditures failed about 2-1. So it seems to me that, you know, Californians love talking about all this great progressive stuff, but they just don't want to tax themselves to fund it. So like, how are, you know, I mean, I'm just going to bring up Prop 13 reform every time I can. I see Laura laughing because it's one of her favorite topics as well. You know, how are we going to actually raise the money to fund our public services at not just an adequate level? It is inadequate now. We need to even be doing better, given that we know the cuts that are coming during the Trump era.
In fairness, in San Francisco, at least, you know, we did vote to tax ourselves to fund City College. We passed the soda tax, and of course the BART bond is, you know, raises property taxes. You know, in terms of the sales tax, that was a problem where, you know, my desire from the very beginning was to make it a dedicated transportation sales tax requiring a two-thirds vote, and those have a history of passing in San Francisco. Because it was separated as a general sales tax and the charter amendment with the expenditure plan, the challenge with that is you have to run a massive campaign to tie the two together, which really did not happen here. It happened some towards the end, but it wasn't enough. And so when people look at the ballot question is, do you want to raise your sales tax? People say no. If you say, do you want to raise your sales tax to pay for better transportation, people tend to say yes. But it is the case that, I mean, it's definitely hard to raise taxes to pay for public services. For the transportation plan that we've introduced, it fixes and increases the gas tax. It increases a vehicle license fee and increases a few other transportation-related fees, like related to diesel fuel, et cetera, to pay. And so I'm hoping we'll be able to get a two-thirds vote in the legislature with our new Democratic two-thirds majority to actually pass those funding measures. In terms of Prop 13, a lot of us would like to see a split roll put into place to take at least larger commercial property out of Prop 13. There are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can do it on some sort of scale, or you can do it as a whole. But it does not make sense that the Bank of America building enjoys the same Prop 13 protection, for example, as my 500 square foot condo. That should be fixed. The polling is not great on it. It polls in the low to mid 50s. It would be a statewide constitutional amendment. And we know that the business community would probably spend $100 million to defeat it. And the whole campaign would be, they're coming for your house next. And so it's unclear that it could pass statewide.
Well, anyone who tries to take a whack at Prop 13 will be a hero in our book. And Scott, while you may already be a hero in our book, you know, I'm just saying, if you really want to get up there, take a whack at Prop 13. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. This has been really great and interesting. We are so excited for all the work that you're going to be doing, and can't wait to, you know, support more housing and transportation bills that we know you're going to be putting forward. I guess any last words from everybody?
Yeah, keep fighting. We have a lot of work to do.
Keep fighting.